really that good avenue after all. At least, you know, I'll get your comment on that.
That's the view I would prescribe to, is that nothing was really happening in North Carolina on the one hand. You had one party control. There was really no competition. In other states, there was some competition. North Carolina had a good reputation because it has produced some very decent people. Terry Sanford was a decent governor. He got a good image that was built for him outside of North Carolina, and therefore the state benefited from that. And when you look back through the history of governors and other kinds of things, we've had some fairly decent and outstanding governors. Luther Hodges did go on to become Secretary of Commerce, and so that helped North Carolina. So a lot of people started to look at North Carolina as sending forth some great leaders, and so if we were sending forth all these great leaders, we had to have all these great people internally. Secondly, I suppose one of the things that has always concerned me about North Carolina is that you found the black leadership basically concentrated mostly in the Durham situation and some other urban areas, but mostly in Durham. It's where you had your class. And you had the John Wheelers, the John Stewarts, the North Carolina Mutual people. And Durham is probably one of the few cities in the South, with the exception of Atlanta, where there's such a clear-cut class among blacks, economically and otherwise. And so it was rather easy for these individuals to be accepted in the roles that they played and not be concerned about the black in eastern North Carolina. In the meantime, the black in eastern North Carolina was either too powerless or too docile or so uneducated because of the high migration rate that he or she wasn't saying anything. And then, of course, the old adage that one often heard, as I did from Georgia, when you looked at North Carolina, you were not sure whether North Carolina was a southern state or a northern state. And you just pretty much decided that when you heard the word North Carolina, that you really weren't thinking about the South, and so you never took a real close look at it. It wasn't until I came here in 1964 that my attitude toward North Carolina about what truly was inside of the boundaries of this state changed. I came here thinking that there was no other state in the southern sphere of this nation that was racially as progressive as the state of North Carolina. I did not know any difference until I got here.
That's true. You think that Key was just wrong, that it was a myth?
I think it was a myth. I don't think the race relations was that good. I think the relationship that existed here was a paternal, maternal relationship, basically between the blacks and the whites, and those blacks who were in power aided in that paternal relationship.
The race issue barely had been submerged.
Yes.
And in fact, we heard one theory is what happened when Key just got seduced by Chapel Hill.
Well, that was easy, you know. We try to do that over here.
That intrigues me because you articulated that thing the same way a white reporter did it, almost the same words.
He said, the closer you got to North Carolina, the less progressive it looked. And the further away you got, the more progressive you got. The image.
Well, but it's see, still quite interesting.
There was one other possible explanation, but I was interested in hearing yours, because you got focused a little more clearly in my mind. This was a question that because North Carolina had this progressive image, when the Civil Rights Revolution came, less attention was focused on North Carolina by anyone, and that the effects of change brought about was not nearly, psychologically, was not nearly as strong a force. Not nearly as traumatic an experience in North Carolina as it was in other southern states, and so that what has happened is that even if North Carolina may have been more progressive, that it has changed less, whereas the rest of the South has changed so much more.
I think that this is somewhat true. We don't like to admit it, including myself. I often ask myself the question, and I was talking to someone about this about a week ago, as to how much has North Carolina really changed when you really get down to the bare bones of it. To be sure, there's been some change, and one has to often ask the question, how much is toleration and how much is true to change? I don't know. I don't know if I can answer the question. I don't know if I really know. I know that the school integration situation here could have been worse had it not been for, say, a Terry Sanford. Had that been another governor, I'm sure North Carolina would have gotten a great deal more attention with this desegregation problems. But Terry, I think, handled it in an astute fashion. But also, because there were Terry Sanfords, and because North Carolina did not get the attention, you see, the pressure was never brought to bear as greatly on the state. That's one of the reasons the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is having such a hard time right now with HEW, is that very few people thought about coming to Chapel Hill, or after my election, who would think about coming to Chapel Hill and looking at the University of North Carolina and its progress toward integration. You go to University of Mississippi, University of Tennessee, University of Alabama, and these other bad states, Georgia.
But
not Chapel Hill, you see. So they were able to get away with a lot over there that some of us here were aware of. But you see, I'm friendly with the chancellor, so I go and sit down with the chancellor, and I say, you know, chancellor, we ought to do these things. Not this chancellor, but the chancellor before. And chancellor says, yes, we're going to do those things. But, you know, there was no mandate for the chancellor to do it. He was only talking to the mayor. But then when HEW came in, it made an entirely different thing. You see, I think the same theory applies to North Carolina that applies, and it, as it relates to the rest of the southern states, as applies to the North as it relates to the South, that no one has ever gone really to the North and identified the very damaging and difficult problems they have racially there. Therefore, the North is under no pressure to change or to do anything different than what it's ever done. But because the South was held up so much for public view, it is under constant pressure to change, and people will not let off the South for a long time. You'd be amazed as to how many black faculty people come into Chapel Hill and come into this office and ask me right now, will I be happy as a black living in Chapel Hill? Will my kids be happy? Will they be discriminated against? After all, Chapel Hill is the South. Will I be happy living in Durham? Can my kids go to any school they want to go? Can I live anywhere I want to live? Can I eat in any restaurant I want to eat in? You see, there are still these fears that are built into people. There are some restaurants in New York City that would lock up the door and turn out the lights before they would let me come in there. But some of these very same people are coming out of New York and don't even know that. I found some in Washington, D.C. that I have had to call to the attention of some people there. They didn't know that, but they would yet point a finger at North Carolina or Mississippi or South Carolina and say, you know, you idiots down there are still living under an oppressive type of atmosphere. So North Carolina, in relation to the other southern states, I think it in somewhat that same boat. Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, and all these have been held up. But you see, when you look at the political arena, next year, because of reapportionment, Alabama will have approximately 24 black state legislators. North Carolina only has 3. South Carolina, though they got defeated in the Republican sweep out the last time, elected 3 blacks to the state legislature at one time. 4. North Carolina had to elect 1, and then, but 1 more, and then 1, and we finally got 3. We have nobody in the state senate. Georgia had a black in the state senate in 1954. Mississippi has probably, I think, more blacks now elected to public office across the state than North Carolina. So when you really look at the amount of actual progress is being made in practically every category in this state, we're behind.
Including economics. There is a
yes.
Per capita wages and that sort of thing. Yes. Still, as Jack says, 47, 48, 49,
yeah.
So forth.
Yeah.
Yeah, why is black voter registration so low in North Carolina compared to other, even compared to other?
I think several reasons. I think that, again, there was never the concentration on voter registration in North Carolina as in other southern states. Even when Vernon Jordan headed up the voter education project, he did not give North Carolina the attention he should have given it. Secondly, the voter education project out of Atlanta has never put the money into this state as it put into Mississippi and Alabama. And thirdly, the director of voter education we had here in North Carolina was not the strongest person we could have had in that particular position. And fourthly, again, most of the blacks in North Carolina are still concentrated very much in the agricultural sections of the state, which means they're relatively dependent. And of course, we have not yet been blessed with the return of a lot of our young people into the state of North Carolina, and the age, the black is still very old in this state and is getting older instead of getting younger. So it's really rather difficult to get a 50-year-old man or 45-year-old lady to go to the polls and register and vote.
In South Carolina, though, it's the equivalent black belt counties. In the 6th Congressional District in South Carolina, Johnny McMillan's old district.
True.
It's the only congressional district in South Carolina that Congressional District voted for Hubert Humphrey.
Yeah.
They're around 36%, you recall, as Roy Stevens ran and made the runoff against McMillan. Mm-hmm. And the same is true. In those counties, though, there's a lot of strong indigenous black political leadership. Usually it's middle class. It's usually traditional. It's usually, they're usually either ministers or funeral home directors.
So but you might recall, might recall in South Carolina that one of the reasons for this is that SCLC went in with this big campaign against McMillan because of his activities in relation to the District of Columbia, and they spent months in there organizing against McMillan and training the people and teaching them and putting the money in there and the educational processes. And when they came out, although they did not defeat him at that particular time, they had, in fact, created one heck of a machine that McMillan knew he had to deal with.
Yeah, but even before that, most of those counties had strong black voters.
Is that right?
Yeah. Did an analysis of South Carolina statewide computerized voter registration. And you can actually, I just saw some returns recently, that it shows the actual breakdown by race of the number of registered voters by county, you can do it by precinct, who actually voted. And of those who were registered statewide, blacks voted something like 9% less than white, right? Mm-hmm. 54% against 63%. Mm-hmm. You had some of those low country counties, like Williamsburg County, where 70% of the blacks voted.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazingly high. I wish we could get that going here in North Carolina. It's absolutely amazing that in 3 months in the 2nd District, through my campaign effort, we were able to register 18,000 blacks, and that did not get 50% of the unregistered blacks in the 2nd District of North Carolina. And yet, when voting time came around, 17,000 of the 40,000 of the 65,000 registered that we needed to get to the polls, we couldn't get. Mainly because of some were in the tobacco fields, naturally. The leadership was not there on the local level, and it still isn't to some degree. You can't really get lawyers in eastern North Carolina. There's still a lot of subtle oppressiveness in eastern North Carolina. You take a lawyer, for an example, will not become politically active in eastern North Carolina for the most part, because he has to go and practice in a court, and he doesn't want to take that risk. Teachers are the most difficult. Black teachers are the most difficult to become politically active because of the decrease in the number of black teachers in the public school. Those who are remaining there are not willing to take any kind of risk by becoming involved politically. Doctors seem to be so involved in practicing medicine, which is probably a big demand on that time, too, because there's so few, do not seem to have the time to get involved. And you can take your professional people. So when you get down to where the leadership is really coming from, it ends up coming out of the man who works in the textile factory, in the mill, or in the tobacco field, or sharecropping. And he can only do so much.
Well, how about what I call a traditional black preacher, politician, and the undertaker, people who have sort of not economically and traditionally haven't been economically dependent on the white community.
You know, that's a funny sort of thing. We find many aggressive undertakers, but we also find so many of our black undertakers have sold their souls before they become involved in politics. They either sold it to the casket manufacturer in order to get caskets on his floor display, or he sold it to the car dealer in order to get his rolling stock to be able to provide the funeral services he needs, or he sold it to the bank to get the working capital in order to carry on his business. And I found an amazingly high number of people such as this in North Carolina, which is not true in South Carolina. I've run across, for an example, the last time I was in South Carolina and Mississippi, those are the two states that I've looked at lately, I found quite a few independent black preacher-type morticians, some of whom had a chain of funeral homes of 9, 10 across the state. I suppose in North Carolina, in most cases, you're talking about a one funeral home owner, mortician, and very few of them are preachers.
No, I didn't mean the combination. I mean, in South Carolina, a lot of the leadership come from one of those two groups.
One thing I found, again, in eastern North Carolina is that so many of the preachers live in the Durhams, the Raleighs, and the large urban areas, and then commute in on Sunday once a month and preach and then come out again.
That would make a difference.
You mentioned Sanford several times. Could you look back, at least during your experience in this state, and make some comments about the various administrations and any real progress that the state may have undergone, or the party? Was there any administrations that are outstanding?
Well, I was coming into North Carolina as Sanford was going out of office. I had known of Sanford before getting here because of some of the obvious outstanding work he'd done in the area of education. And of course, I was in Georgia at the time, and Sanford was being presented in the state of Georgia as one of the South's most outstanding governors. I think this was in part because of his initial support of John Kennedy, which gave him a lot of national attention right off the bat. I came in about the time the Rich Pryor, Beverly Lake, Dan Moore square off was beginning to take shape. I always thought Governor Moore's administration was overtly kind of weak. I didn't see very much progress being made for the state there. But when one looked closer at Governor Moore, one found that he probably brought more minorities into government than any other governor had previous to that time. Governor Scott, I did not feel, offered us the kind of government that I felt not only he was capable of offering, but that North Carolina demanded at that time. So, with the exception of regionalism, which was a concept that came out in reorganization, and the basic concept of annual sessions, I felt that the Scott administration would not have what I would consider to be an outstanding record. Now, those are the only two administrations in North Carolina that I've really lived under, and if I had to compare the two, I suppose I would have to go with the Scott administration as being a little more productive than the Moore administration. If I were asked to compare Sanford, Scott, and Moore, I would have to go with the Sanford administration as having been, at least overtly, the most progressive in terms of producing for the state. And I suppose the only thing that Sanford has against him is the fact that he brought in the sales tax in North Carolina, and that's always going to be around to haunt him for a while at least. As one tests minority attitude around the state, I found that, of course, Sanford stands head and shoulders above any administration in the state in recent history. And second to the Sanford administration, believe it or not, the Moore administration stands high in the minds of most minorities, particularly blacks.
How about 1 year of Holzhauser?
1 year of Holzhauser, I think, is not really enough to make a conclusive judgment yet. I do know that what he's done up to this point has made him greatly attractive to minorities. My personal view of Holzhauser is that he talked a good story, but I don't think that he's lived up to the rhetoric that he expounded during his campaign and, of course, during his inaugural. I certainly have been one of the first to commend him for the boldness of being able to open up government and to certainly appoint qualified blacks to sit in seats of decision. I think Governor Holzhauser has the potential of being a good governor. I think he's an astute type individual, and he's fairly well intelligent. I think, on the other hand, he has surrounded himself with people who are not as bright as I think a governor could surround himself with, and this may be his ultimate downfall rather than what he himself is capable of doing.
We had someone say make a similar observation as your last one, and said it was comparable to the kind of people that Governor Scott surrounded himself with.
Yes. I think probably so. This, I think, was one of Scott's downfalls. He had many good ideas because I talked with him about them, but they never got beyond the front office. And many ideas that one fed into Governor Scott never got beyond the front office. And I think the same thing would be true with Holzhauser.
One idea we heard is that you're running for lieutenant governor.
It's very much on my mind. Unless things change significantly, and if I feel like I can put it all together, it will be my intent to be out there in 1976, very much in the heat of things.
For some statewide officer, specifically lieutenant governor?
It will be specifically lieutenant governor. Probably at this point, there would be nothing else statewide that would interest me.
About Secretary of State, you have that big office with the door, but it hasn't been closed for 37
years. Get in and close the door. I looked at Secretary of State at one time, but I think that I'd be bored to death if I were elected to a record-keeping job.
And I can guarantee it.
I see the lieutenant governor's position in the state of North Carolina as being similar to the mayor's position in Chapel Hill. I think it's something that has not really ever been used to its fullest potential, even when it was a ceremonial type position. I really see that, not that this position can or should be used to overshadow what the governor is or what the governor should be, but the lieutenant governor sits in a position to be able to influence so much good legislation, and he has a different kind of leadership role to play.
Wasn't that the thinking behind making it full-time and giving it a fairly good salary?
That was my thought.
So that
was my
thought. Assign some administrative responsibilities to it as well as just the presiding function?
That was my understanding. I think probably one will probably not be able to make a good realistic assessment under the current setup.
What kind of a coalition do you have to put together to win that?
I don't know. First of all, I want to get the party locked in to me. Whatever, if we can ever get the party together. I think that my thoughts at this point would be, number one, to zero in on this sleeping black vote, which is not yet moved. I think it has to be awakened. I really think that increased registration and particularly increased education will have to be done. My idea would be to put together a young black coalition initially, and use this particular segment of it as the troops to get these young, energetic people believing in me, believing that I'll bring something to government that they can live with, believe in, and have a part in. And from that, I would hope to pull together the impossible dream, the coalition. The central core of my bloc would be the working class blacks and the working class white coalition. Talking about those issues that affect these groups of people. And I feel certainly that there are other elements out there that I can naturally draw in on, but I think I will have to really work at pulling together the working black and working white coalition.
One of the issues you mentioned was health delivery, delivery of health care services. Are there any other that come to mind that would help weld that together?
Delivery of health care the whole question of taxes and tax reform, true tax reform, the situation involving housing and making it possible for us to have more and better housing here, the idea of trying to find a means by which North Carolina will improve, continue to improve the quality of jobs that are brought into the state. Right now, those are just some of the basic issues that I have.
How about education?
Education, surely. I think one of the things that was missed very much in Skipper's campaign, and I don't know whether it was the timing on it, whether people just didn't hear, was the importance of vocational education that I think needs to be pushed and emphasized here. So that would be something I'd want to bring in very much as part of my campaign.
How is Sam Ervin perceived these days in the black community in North Carolina?
Amazingly enough, quite well. I just hope he doesn't continue to try to pound on this busing amendment that he's talking about. Senator Sam's stock has gone up by about 200% in the black community, including with me. I was probably as much opposed to Senator Sam Ervin two and a half years ago as anybody could possibly be in public office. And, of course, I did not hesitate to verbalize my dissatisfaction and dislike of the senator. I've come to know the senator a little better now, to have a chance to talk with him, to have a chance to express to him some of my views and to hear some of his views. We don't agree on many things, but the fact that I found some things that we do agree on has certainly made me feel a lot more comfortable with him and a lot better about him. The black community generally, I think, looks upon Senator Sam with a greatly positive attitude, and if he were to run for re-election, I think you'd find that he would get, unlike in past years, tremendous support out of the black community.
In the primary, say against Morgan?
Yes. Yes. I think that Morgan's stock is very low in the black community throughout the state of North Carolina, mainly for several reasons. One is his ties and identification with I. Beverly Lake, which he has not been able to shake very, very well. Secondly, he has gone around the state and presented himself in many quarters as a conservative, which doesn't set well in the black community. And thirdly, Morgan has apparently been involved in some cases involving blacks where there was a general feeling that he did not try to ensure that justice would be done in these cases. So those three things I've heard often as I've moved around the state being held against him.
How about Henry Hall?
Henry Hall is not known well enough. He has not been able to project himself into the black community, and therefore I would say not more than 0.5% knows who Henry Hall is or that he even exists.
And you think Ervin pretty much has overcome his old votes against civil rights legislation insofar as the black community is concerned?
Well, people are going to always remember it, including me. But I think what people are looking at now is that Ervin has had a fairly decent vote on individual rights. I think people are willing to kind of let the civil rights vote be bygone at this point. I don't think that people would look kindly, including myself, on the senator pushing for a strong anti-busing amendment if he does it on the basis of the preventing of the integration of schools. Amazingly enough, the black community is not all that pro-busing. Matter of fact, I think based on what I've felt, I have no facts to back this up, I would estimate that more than 50% of the black community would prefer to see busing discontinued. But they don't like amendments introduced to discontinue it, for this is perceived, whether it is done so in the spirit of not as being anti-black and anti-integration. I think Senator Sam could open a lot of old wounds and a lot of old faults with this kind of act that are now being swept under the rug.
Reapportionment having played any significant effect in North Carolina?
Not at this point, I don't. As a matter of fact, I think it's played havoc with North Carolina, and I'm not sure that North Carolina has gone through in a true sense of reapportionment. I think we played games with it, just as we did when we realigned the districts and took Chapel Hill out of the 4th District, Orange County rather, out of the 4th District, and stuck it as a thumb on the 2nd District, all of which was perceived by some of us to be designed for two basic reasons. One was to knock Nick Galifianakis out of Congress, and the other was to keep me from going, because I think I could have been elected hands down almost in the 4th District. Other than that, we don't really see, I don't personally really see that any significant changes have taken place. Certainly the reapportionment did not in any way affect the basis upon which the black vote could have any significant impact on the outcome of political elections.
I'd like to just fill in one gap, and that's in your life a little bit. Where exactly, what was your family, how many kids in the family you grew up? Was your father a farmer?
My father, when I was born, my father, grandfather, mother, and grandmother, and aunt all lived together in one farmhouse, and they were sharecroppers. They sharecropped until I was about 4 years old, at which time my father took a public job with the WPA. He became what they call a rock quarry worker, and he remained in that job in a grit mill, and went from that job to the Southern Railroad, and then ultimately to his present position as in the X-ray department at Emory University. My mother, when they left the farm, taught school and completed high school, taught in a one-room country school and completed high school, and then completed college. As a matter of fact, she graduated 2 months after I graduated from college, 1959. My grandfather left with my grandmother and aunt the farm when I was 7, 8 years old. I stayed with my grandparents on the farm until they finally left, at which time my grandfather went into the mortician business and also started a fleet of taxicabs. And he ran the mortician business and ran the taxicab company until he was 62, at which time he retired, stayed retired for 2 years, and then decided to go back to work and worked in a textile mill in Georgia, and then retired at age 67 and died at age 69.
You went to school where, college?
Did my undergraduate work at Fort Valley State College in Georgia, and then in the Army, then 3 years as a probation officer, and then graduate work here at UNC.
And social work?
Social work. Masters in social.
You mentioned something about being active in civil rights in Georgia. What were you doing then? What period was that?
This was 1961 to 64. I worked with Hosea Williams and the Chatham County Crusade for Voters at that time, doing a couple of things. I was working as a juvenile probation officer. We were using a lot of kids in demonstrations. And one phase I played in it until I got caught was that the kids were being brought into the juvenile home, and I had the key to the juvenile home, and they would bring them in the front door, and we'd take them out the back door. Kept running the same kids in and out of the same demonstration. Well, after I left there, this was almost 1964 by then, I led some civil rights demonstrations and helped plan some strategies and so forth. And then I was faced with the choice of going with Dr. King, with SCLC, or going to graduate school. I chose to come to graduate school. I had had enough of civil rights by 1964. It was a kind of an experience that I think you could stay in for 2, possibly 3 years. And you could be nonviolent for 2 or 3 years. And if you really didn't believe in violence, you had to get out of it for a while. And I felt that I was reaching a point to where I just couldn't be nonviolent anymore out there, and that I would do the whole movement more damage when I left, came to graduate school.
I did have one more, and that is, where do you see blacks going and the Republican Party going? Where do you see blacks and the Republican Party? What sort of relationship in the South, in North Carolina and in the South? Because it's really two different questions there in a sense.
Yes. Well, I think, number one, in the South, the Republican Party is, in fact, going to become a party to have to be contended with. And I think in some ways this is healthy. I feel and have often felt that a two-party system is a lot healthier than a one-party system. So I really think we'll see the Republican Party grow in the South. I think we'll also see the Republican Party grow in North Carolina. I think probably not as fast as a lot of people would perceive it. I don't think there will be as much Democratic crossover as a lot of people think, but I really feel that the Republican Party will be here for a while. I think that generally the attitude of the Republicans in the South will tend to shift somewhat, because I've never felt that the Republican Party in the South, like the National Republican Party, was so much controlled by big business any more than the Democratic Party in the South was controlled by big business. I mean, they both got the big money in there. But both these parties, because just purely of the makeup of the South, are somewhat going to be used as a common people's party. I see the Republican Party increasing in the number of blacks. And I see that the black who will remain with the Democratic Party will be basically the kind of person who is a progressive thinker, a issue-oriented type person, if the party can stay on that beat, like myself, who will stay with that Democratic Party. I see the black going with the Republican Party as being more of the conservative black, and probably the Republican Party in the South, to some degree, unless it changes nationally, will probably attract the businessman type. Black Republican, the lawyer type, that type of an individual, the one with a little money. And I think you'll find blacks will tend to turn more conservative in the South, some blacks. You won't be able to talk about conservative anymore in the vein of, when you say conservative, you actually mean white, or liberal, you actually mean black and white together. It's not going to be that clear in the South anymore. Nationally, I think the life for blacks is probably just about as good in the Republican Party as it is in the Democratic Party. I just happen to be a loyal, totally committed Democrat. My family was Republican for long, long years, and I became Democrat in the early 1960s when John Kennedy was running, and got my whole family to switch over to the Democratic Party. We've been Democrats ever since. But before Eisenhower, with the exception of the era of Roosevelt, my family voted completely and totally Republican across the line. So I'm not unfamiliar with the Republican Party and am not totally alien to it. I think we'll see a great deal more competitiveness between the two parties. I think the greatest hope, however, and this is my own built-in prejudice, for blacks in the South is still in the Democratic Party.
What is Dr. Horton's role in the Roosevelt administration?
We're still trying to figure that out. There are many of us who just don't know. He is said to be an assistant to the governor with basic responsibility for minority affairs. We're not sure what Dr. Horton is supposed to be doing, what capabilities he has to do what he's been assigned to do. I basically think that Dr. Horton is there for one reason, and that is to do everything possible to attract as many blacks any way possible to the Republican Party.
Is there anything else you wanted to add? Questions?
I think y'all have covered the waterfront.
Do you have any other questions?
That is, Terry Sanford in the presidential primary last year, you were supporting his candidacy. I understand before that you were in the committed Muskie camp. How do you perceive that race and what effect it had and what effect did it have on Sanford's standing in the state? And why were you supporting it?
Well, I supported it for several reasons. First of all, I felt that Terry Sanford brought a different Southern image to the national scene, and I felt that we in the South needed that. I did feel at that point that George Wallace's presentation of himself as a Southerner did not speak well for us as Southerners across the nation. And I felt and do feel continuously that we've got very enlightened Southern leaders down here, and I think the other part of the country ought to be aware of that. Secondly, I felt and still feel very strongly that it's time for us to have a Southerner as vice president. If we really want to talk about bringing the country together, then we can't keep having Northern presidents and vice presidents up there who have no more of an understanding or commitment to being able to get things done along any of these lines than some of our Southerners do. I can think of a lot of people. So I felt Terry fitted this bill. I don't know how it hurt, might have affected his standing in the state. I think Terry, and I often said this to him, started his campaign too late, even in North Carolina. He played it too cozy, and he kept, people never quite knew where he was going. He kept saying president or nothing when everybody knew that it would have taken a whole lot of strength to walk away from the vice presidency that he offered to. So basically, I think those things affected him, but I'm not sure that Terry left the state any worse off than he was when he stopped out. My suggestion to him was that he not even run in North Carolina because I knew the tax situation. I thought he should have bypassed North Carolina.
We've set up an institute of politics.